This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 4th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 147th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're all over the place, but in a good way. If we've got a theme, maybe it's learning. We are an empty vessel, as you know. First up, we're sitting down with a self-professed piano genius, Chilly Gonzalez, you know, for a lesson.
That's the essence of the blues right there. Can you hear it? Can you hear the life I've lived?
We'll speak to novice Alex Preston about his new book and how to weave fact into fiction.
My hero is the only fictional character in it. So you have all of these characters who are either absolutely faithful representations of people who really lived or who are very clearly drawn on historical figures.
And we'll speak to the curator of a brilliantly named show at the V&A, Disobedient Objects.
Lots of these objects are made very quickly under pressure, and when you contrast them with kind of objects of fine making in the rest of the V&A, they might seem to fail. But if you start to look at them on their own terms about why they were made and what they achieve, then it's a very different story.
Plus, we'll meet the two Londoners who've managed to do publishing on the most charmingly small scale. We'll go to a swing festival near Stockholm and play a few tracks from our favourite records of the summer so far. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. And just because we're saving this week's Midori House session for next week to fit in with a cunning theme, this time we're taking a left turn from the regular and just playing a handful of songs from our favourite records of the summer so far. First up, maybe not much of a surprise, but it sounds so good coming out of your radio set, why not? From their album Nobuma Rubber Band, here are Little Dragon with Pretty Girls.
You magnify the universe, grab your purse, grab your love, pretty girl, don't get stuck. You're aiming for the royal scene, the fast luck, the TV dreams, pretty girl, don't get struck.
That was Little Dragon doing Pretty Girls from their latest great album, Nobuma Rubber Bands, and they're touring literally everywhere other than Neptune this summer, and they're very good live. Right. Shall we start our piano lesson? We'll only be taught by the best, of course. And who better than the classically trained virtuoso who's made pop records of an intensity, intelligence and wit, and who's collaborated with every star from hip-hop artists to divas. He's had a couple of solo piano albums out recently and a book for lapsed piano players such as myself called Reintroduction Etudes that's written to relight the ivory tinkling fire in one's belly. Ahead of a live show at Camden's Roundhouse, Chilly Gonzalez. Who else took time for a one-on-one?
We are, and this is the first episode of Sharing a Stool.
I think it's such a good title. We could do this on any kind of genre, piano lessons, maybe someone that, you know, has lapsed in being trained as an astronaut, anything. Sharing a stool, I think, can run and run. But where are we going to take it first?
Okay. What kind of music do you like?
I probably like rock music the best.
The piano is a great rock instrument. For example, Jerry Lee Lewis, one of the first real punk rockers and arguably the first person to kind of abuse his instrument as a kind of political statement. I think before Jimi Hendrix did some of his more theatrical violation of the guitar's dignity, there was Jerry Lee Lewis. And I guess Jerry Lee Lewis did a lot with very, very little. He used something called the blues scale. And this is something that you hear a lot in that kind of boogie-woogie music. The thing about the blues scale is it's really easy to find because almost every single note in the blues scale is a black note. So play me now the five black notes.
So what do we got here?
Exactly. Now that's called the pentatonic scale. And you hear, there's a lot of great melodies that have been written in the pentatonic scale already, you know? And it's great for heavy metal, right? This is only the black keys.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you can just do a big swipe with your hand on just the black keys. There you go, see?
Perfect. The butterflies are subsiding. I've got a bit of power going on, a bit of fire in the belly now.
Yeah, see, that's how you end the piece. So you already know how the piece is going to end. When a big flourish like that, as if the harpist in the orchestra was going and just like ending that piece on a resounding triumphal note, you know. So I think that's, you've got the ending, which is sometimes the most stressful part of what to do when you play the piano. So we have this pentatonic scale. I just want to point out that in some Asian cultures, they only have these five notes, and that's why you can do this kind of borderline culturally insensitive kind of parody. You know, you could kind of do that kind of so-called Asian music in a sort of very stereotypical manner with these black keys. But it's interesting that you can divide up the octave, which is the distance between this and this. There's 12 notes, but different cultures have different numbers of scale. They divide it up differently, so to speak. So the blues scale is only the black notes, which you pointed out were this. And we just add in this note here. Can you play that for me, Rob? Okay. So that is the blues scale now. So in theory, we now have all the tools that Jerry Lee Lewis had for his right hand. So one exercise we can try is to go like this. This is a classic Jerry Lee Lewis riff. All right? And so you have to remember that you have this whole scale, but you want to orient always. Orient, right, on this right here. And then use the others to fill in. That's one way you could possibly start. Should we try that?
So this is like this, right?
Yeah.
Something's not right there.
Yeah, what you want to do is you want to use this as a kind of little step. This is called an appoggiatura. The note that people hear is this, but to give it a little bit of swagger, what you do is you play the immediate neighbor note either below or above. In this case, it's below. So we have a B flat, that's our destination note, and we're going to play the A natural right below it, right?
Okay.
That's the essence of the blues right there. Can you hear it? Can you hear the life I've lived?
Yeah. That's right. I can feel that you woke up this morning and something happened to you. Someone left you this morning. I can hear that just in that note.
Either my dog or my wife clearly left me, and only this Jack Daniels can fix it, right? Okay. So you see that you hit normally, but the B flat has that little appoggiatura, the little blue note. And then you can fill in with any of the black notes. You ready?
I feel we finally achieved something here, Chile. You were good, but fair master and teacher, I think.
Now, the semitone that we found the blue note in, I just want to point out that this isn't just something for the blues. For example, this is one of the poetic points of the piano. A voice can kind of hit the blue note in between these two notes. So can a saxophone. It can go like, and go like, it can live in between these two notes. But there's something tragic about the piano because you can't bend the notes like you can on other instruments. So the only way to really approximate that is with things like the blue note, which create a kind of illusion, or just pieces that sort of revolve around the semitone, like, what's Beethoven doing there except pointing out sort of the futility of the piano trying to live in between those two notes? I think there's something very poetic about the fact that the piano is kind of actually a limited instrument, but tries to be the sort of orchestral instrument par excellence, you know? And one last thing about the semitone is that Thelonious Monk, the jazz pianist, he decided to play semitones, these neighbor notes, together, which normally should sound kind of wrong, you know? You know, but he kind of... And in a classical way, you can always rationalize almost every pairing of notes and turn it into something beautiful. So this, if it sounds dissonant at first, can become this. That's Odessa, one of the pieces from the Reintroduction Etudes, for example, where I try to get that semitone and sort of really understand that any two combinations of notes that you can hit can somehow be rationalized with the right harmony behind it. So there is no such thing as a wrong note, actually.
That last thing you played has, is that Satie? That's got such a sense of history to it. I feel like I'm watching a black and white montage of all the sad things that have happened in my and your life.
Yes, well, it's a style of what I would call romantic classical musical writing, which, for better or for worse, that's what we really retain. You know, when we think of classical music, what we really think of, the stuff we like, is heart on its sleeve and melancholy and sadness, and not the guys in powdered wigs prancing around, which is the real classical era. But it's that romantic era that begins with Chopin and Franz Liszt, who was kind of the first megalomaniacal rock star in a way, the first guy to make women faint by the dozens whenever he played. And guys like Beethoven, who were like going deaf but continuing to compose, and kind of, you know, Richard Wagner, who had a kind of Kanye West style idea that he was so convinced that the world needed his art that just that became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And these characters are all from the Romantic era. It's about 1830 to about 1900, and this, I think, is what we always will connect with in classical music, and that's the real juice of what I try to put into my music. And Satie, he comes just at the tail end of that, and he was in a way a very modern guy, so he was kind of taking the achievements of the Romantic masters and kind of distilling them into these kind of installation style moments. You know, a real composer from the Romantic era would probably do, but Satie was kind of already a minimalist, so to speak, and he would just kind of break it down into its most, like, you know, he would just sample the best bit in a way a hip-hop producer just grabs the best loop off a record, you know. And that continues to be my approach, you know. I write pop songs because there's only one or two addictive motifs in them. And all of the color and all of the sneaky harmonic tricks, they come from classical music, but I am worshiping at the altar of pop music, of the perfect addictive 2 or 3 minute song.
And the entry into those addictive moments, is it things like the semitone? Is it the blues note? Is it the things that sound like they're maybe not in tune? Is that the thing that gets your ear bending in the right direction, that gets your ear bending towards the radio?
Well, it's a good thing. The way the ear bends is to create just enough expectation, and then to satisfy just enough expectation, but to also surprise. And what you want is kind of ambiguity. You want moments where you're not 100% clear if it's finished or not, and then you have the chance to kind of pull the rug out from people. I think of harmonic stories that can be told, like a chord progression. Some people go like, I just like the minor chords. And I kind of joke with this on stage and talk about the difference between major and minor. The truth is, there's always major and minor mixed up, not only in life, but in good music. If it was only minor chords, it would sound like a parody of some kind of
funeral.
Yeah. There's just, you know, there's no hope in there at all. And I think in life, sadness and joy and all those things, they're constantly in interplay. So you always need, and then pull the rug out. We're somewhere else now. But now I actually brought you to where you thought you were going in the first place. So what you've done is create an expectation, and then all of a sudden you take them somewhere else, but you're like, hold on to that expectation, I'm just going to go somewhere else, quick little detour, and then we end up where you thought. And this is kind of like flirting with the audience in a way. It's kind of keeping them guessing what your real motivation is and how the story is going to end. It's about ambiguity so that the listener or the object of your flirtation will fill in the rest and hopefully fill in with positive projection.
And just maybe finally, before we do a Jerry Lee sign-off, Chilly, I wanted to ask you about the idea of solving a song. I've always wanted to know this about you as well, whether or not you listen in the same way to other people with all the different motifs and styles going on in your head when you're writing stuff and just listening to stuff. We're always told that we get addicted to pop songs because we want to solve them like a puzzle. I guess as soon as you solve the puzzle, you move on to the next song. Is it the same when you're writing music?
Well, I write mostly instrumental music these days, and I've never been someone who's tapped into the universal combination of a perfect lyric with a perfect melody the way Pharrell Williams or the sort of genetically, you know, imbued pop choruses that you hear blaring out of radios every summer. That's not really my expertise. Of course, I do appreciate that. And for me, solving a problem musically, I have so many tools, and that's because I was perhaps an overtrained musician for what I really wanted to be doing. And it took me a while to kind of undo that training, but it does come in handy because I have a method, and it's not the method I would recommend necessarily to other people. It's very technical, and it involves just a lot of patience and waiting and listening back to yourself and working on the the twin sort of consciousnesses of being inside the music as you make it and then also listening as if you were an audience member. It's kind of a splitting off of yourself that is pretty traumatic and painful. And when you can really do it, it really helps you solve problems. Not everyone can do it. And I have seen musicians who do it without realizing they're doing it. And most good musicians do it. If I work with Boys Noize, if I work with Drake, you get the feeling that they, at certain points they're inside, and then you kind of observe and you almost see a different glaze come over their eyes, and all of a sudden they're listening in a different way, and they're listening as the creator of the brand that they've made, sort of projecting onto what they assume their listeners think and kind of trying to get that. So when I'm playing the piano, when I'm on stage, there's a lot of that duality going on.
So it sounds like before you pack your suitcase to go off and perform a gig, you're taking stuff out of it, you're not putting stuff into it.
I think there's a song in there.
Well, maybe we should do the sign off. You can remind me of what the chord is.
We're going to take it a little bit down tempo now. Yeah, exactly. We got that, and then all the black keys. Yeah.
Okay. No, just use that
black keys, and then just this one is the blues.
Ah, okay. That was Chilly Gonzalez, who's continuing his tour all over the shop. The internet will tell you where, if you don't mind. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Disobedient Objects is the latest exhibition at London's Victoria and Albert Museum. It presents articles used in protest and items made by those striving for social change since the 1970s. How can political activism influence the way we design, and how does rebellion nurture creativity? Dorothy Fever went down to the show while it was still slightly under construction to find out.
So I'm heading up the marble steps of the V&A, and there's a Free Palestine demo going on just down the street. But apparently the spirit of protest doesn't stop there. I'm here to meet curators Catherine Flood and Gavin Grindon, who are going to show me around.
We've entered the exhibition by crossing a barricade, essentially. The doors of this exhibition are big and black. They presented the perfect idea of the barricade, and we've covered them with a large kind of white diagram drawing that references 400 years of barricade making and the different changing materials that, from barrels that, through to the kind of present day that people have used.
There's something almost quite funny about how the idea of a disobedient object, something that's a protest object or going against the system, is now somehow sanctioned by being within one of, you know, the most splendid institutions that Britain has.
Protest and direct action is one of the most splendid institutions that this country has, and so it's entirely appropriate that they should be in a public museum as a space to publicly debate and discuss, you know, how that happens and how it proceeds.
We're saying that this is an important part of our culture that we should pay attention to. So doing it in a large museum where we can bring these objects to a wide audience was a very good place to do that. I mean, certainly it does create some kind of contrasts and incongruities. Lots of these objects are made very quickly, under pressure, and when you contrast them with kind of objects of fine making in the rest of the V&A, they might seem to fail. But if you start to look at them on their own terms about why they were made and what they achieve, then it's a very different story.
We've got some amazing banners overhead, and I should point out that the exhibition is still being made.
Yep.
But we're also surrounded by these amazing scaffolding kind of poles.
So there was a whole discussion about how do we display this stuff? You can't put it in a glass case on a velvet cushion. And it wouldn't also be appropriate for the V&A to, you know, pretend to be really edgy, pretend and put this. So we had to come up with something that kind of respected the objects in their own terms, used sympathetic materials, didn't turn them into a kind of an artistic fetish, but also didn't turn them into just ephemera, like stuff that happened to be there, like Winston Churchill's pipe. One of the other things that happened when we brought all of these things into the room that we didn't entirely expect, they're quite humble objects, they're a bit of cardboard and wood and some paint. And sometimes you might look at them on their own and think, well, what kind of difference did that make to anything? But when you put them all together, you see all of these small acts add up to this kind of collective creative force. and you can begin to understand like the power that these things have and the power that the people behind them have to change things.
One of the oldest pieces in the exhibition is a Chilean arpillera, a textile seen made anonymously in the Pinochet era, as its lender explains.
I'm Roberta Bacic, I'm from Chile originally and live in Northern Ireland. And I have been collecting arpillera since 1975. And this arpillera is extremely typical. It is made from the backing of a flour sack. So a flour sack was cut into six pieces. So six women could make their own story. In those times, they would have torn their clothes as a gesture also of protest and concern and to show the poverty in which they were.
So what we have is a sort of rectangular scene that's been almost crocheted or embroidered.
No, absolutely not. It's stitched. And I make the difference because the only crochet you have is on the border to represent a frame. The women didn't want that this become practical objects like holders for the teapot or whatever. They wanted them to be in a wall to confront you.
And this is specifically a development that happened in the Pinochet era?
Yes, exactly. In the first 3 years, 1974 to 1977, the women were doing these pieces and they were being exported and they could get by because they thought it's women's work, nobody would care for that. And if they look at them, who will believe them what they tell? But suddenly they started to see that these works that were bringing out the untold, the hidden, the unspeakable stories of what was going on in Chile, so they became proscribed. So it became, you could be prosecuted for having them, for selling them, or for making them. So the women worked in that context. Some of the arpilleras, you will find that they had a hidden pocket at the back. This is one of those. Here you can see the pocket that was camouflaged. In that pocket, folded, was this little letter.
So on the very back of the arpillera, there's a tiny stitched pocket, yes, and there's a beautiful, rather delicately written little paper note which is attached to the wall, which survived.
Which has survived all these years. I've had it for about 25 years in my possession. And the interesting thing is that it's used with paper from a school. So clearly the mother used from another child a piece of paper where she scribbled. And if you read the translation that we made, it's very anguished. So it's really provoking us to respond to her appeal, where are our children?
Roberta's devotion to building up a permanent collection of arpilleras is unusual. What really comes across in the exhibition is the sheer chance of disobedient objects surviving at all. Catherine Flood.
There are a few objects in the exhibition that were destroyed and when we've had them remade, but these are recent objects where we've asked the original maker to remake them. So an example is one of the big banners that stretches across the exhibition that says capitalism is crisis. It was used at a climate camp, but also at the Occupy movement in St Paul's in London. And there was a massive debate between the people involved in the Occupy movement as to whether it should say capitalism is crisis or capitalism in crisis. So one letter kind of held all that ideological debate. And so now this banner is being recreated for the exhibition. After the exhibition, it will go back to the maker and can go on and be used in future demonstrations.
And perhaps disappear again.
Who knows?
Disappear. Well, yeah, I mean, that's, people often think of objects coming to a museum and then just dying. And this exhibition doesn't quite function like that. Lots of these objects will go back to the activists who made them. Some of them, where we've commissioned, will go back to the activists who made them and reappear in the streets, be reused by them. So this is almost like, it's more like a pause or a moment of reflection for those objects on what's possible rather than the end of their lives. It's a starting point to think about these things.
That was Dorothy Fever's report from Disobedient Objects, the latest show at London's V&A. If that tickles your fancy, then it's on until next February. After the break, I'll be joined by the novelist, Alex Preston.
Mash Ecoute is a novel retail experience in a 100-year-old former train station in Tokyo. Monocle Films pays a visit to see how old infrastructure can be repurposed to improve urban life.
The shops at Matcha Cute tend to complement the building and each other. As with many of the customers, the businesses setting up here have been drawn by its unusual interiors and historical details. The result is a space where customers can come across a diverse variety of products, all of which form a unified whole.
Retail on the Rails, now playing in the film section on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Alex Preston's third novel, In Love and War, is out now. Set in Florence in the lead-up to and during the outbreak of the Second World War, it's an elegant, gripping thing, a sort of literary thriller that also questions what the novel as a form might be made from, with a few different mediums, letters, prose and radio dispatches woven into the mix. The protagonist, hero perhaps, also just happens to be a young man trying to write a novel. Alex came in to talk about the book and the place where fact and fiction meet.
If you're doing the right thing as a novelist, you're always writing a contemporary novel. And there are so many themes within this book, you know, fascism, you know, the demands of the political life versus the private life, how to exist in war and how we think about that war here 70 years on. But for me, it was much more about the stories. It was telling the story of this young man who comes to Florence in 1937, the son of a member of the British Union of Fascists in the UK, and really about his journey breaking away from that family, breaking away from his background, getting involved in the Italian resistance, and finally learning what it is to be a hero. And those things to me felt timeless. It didn't feel like a story that was in any way, you know, yoked to the past or distant from where we are now.
But it is an interesting way of re-enlivening the history. And there was things that while I was reading the book, I had to look up and preparing to speak to you today. You want to make sure that, you know, that, for example, Carita, one of the kind of real sort of butcher boys, Mussolini's butcher boys of fascism, is clearly a real character. And there are lots of real characters sort of spattered around. Well, not lots of real characters, but there are real...
Oh, no, there are many,
from history
many
spattered around the book. Yeah. How do you get that balance between the fictional and the real... Where do you decide to kind of, you know, put the fulcrum with that?
Yeah, well, I read a really amazing French novel in I think, 2010. So just when I was starting to come up with this idea, it's called HHHH by Laurent Binet.
Which is an amazing, wonderful, sort of post-modern thing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's a novel about the assassination of Heydrich, where it's constantly questioning what historical fiction can do, what moral duty the novelist has to represent a real world. And what I decided to do within Love and War was to try and construct the world of the novel where my hero is the only fictional character in it. So you have all of these characters who are either absolutely faithful representations of people who really lived or who are very clearly drawn on historical figures. I started off thinking it might be a non-fiction book because all of these stories about the resistance in Florence, it was both, you know, one of the sort of hothouses of fascism, but it was also one of the great flowerings of the resistance. So many incredible stories about heroism, about, you know, particularly when the Nazis invaded and Florence, this wonderful, wonderful city under threat from German bombs and British bombs. And I just wanted to render that in a way that felt to me kind of faithful to the history, faithful to the story, faithful to these amazing people who lived and died in order to throw off the yoke of fascism.
And there are a few different voices in the book, Alex. It's written in the third person, but also there's a lot of letters to and from home. There's also nicely some letters to Faber, who he wants to publish his novel, and no small nod to your own work, I suppose, which is kind of funny. But the letters home to his mother, and especially then later on in the novel, his father, are really moving sort of, they're a plot device, but they're really moving as well. How important was it and how important was it to sort of weave these other narrative structures into the book and to have these, a different way of writing, I guess?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've read a lot and spoken a lot about the death of the novel recently. And you know, I mean, everyone's always declaring the death of the novel. And it's just because they don't really understand how much the novel can do. But what I didn't want to do was to tell just a straight narrative, you know, all third person, whatever. I love books where you have letters. In here, you have letters, you have diaries, you have broadcasts, you have all sorts of different ways of getting that story across. I also think it's a way of moving through time. You know, how do you skip from 1939 to 1941 if you should want to? Well, you know, you can do that through letters. You can do that through all sorts of narrative trickery. But it's also, I think readers love that sense of getting all sorts of perspective of what is going on, finding different paths into the characters' minds.
And the book, as I say, it's kind of got a, it progresses steadily, and then you really put the foot down in the last sort of 100 pages. It's got a very, it's got a real sort of thriller denouement
to it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And what about that? Is that something when you're planning that, when you're planning the plot of the novel, whether it's on post-it notes in your study, whether it's very mathematically, or whether it's just one page after the other, when you decide to kind of do that, it doesn't change the genre of the novel at all, but it's a kind of got a very satisfying speed up towards the end.
Well, you know, firstly, I don't plan my novels. I subscribe to E.L. Doctorow's edict, which is, he says, it's like driving at night. You should be able to see just far enough ahead not to crash. And I think that's sort of the way that I write. I let the characters grow into the book. I let them really write the novel for me. But that was a conscious decision that I wanted to have a lot of fun with this book. I wanted it to be gripping. I wanted it to propel you into this, you know, really kind of dramatic and heartrending and powerful ending. And I also just wanted to play with that idea of, you know, taking the thriller genre, taking the way that other people had treated this genre, and really trying to go fairly heavy on the action and on the drama.
We've talked about the various themes and the plot devices and the different voices that are in the book as well. There's a lot of work going on, despite it being a fairly sort of mellifluous read at the same time. Is that something you can plan as a novelist, or is that something that where you're always looking around the next corner for the next bend sort of thing?
No, I think that was very much part of the editing process. It was a much longer book before I did my sort of first edit, which was brutal, and where I cut sort of 30,000 words. And, you know, it was difficult how to get this idea of this young, very relaxed, very kind of sensual young man, and then went him into this sort of razor sharp narrative. And it was, and the way I did it was to write it too long and then to cut back and cut back and cut back until you really just have his story, the kind of tight line of his own personal journey.
That was Alex Preston, and his new novel, In Love and War, is out now, published by Faber and Faber. Still to come in part two, we'll learn about a London-based duo who've been publishing and hand-stitching their own books, and we'll be practicing our best Texas Tommies and Jumping Joes at the Harang Dance Festival in Sweden. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Every year, for 5 weeks in summer, hundreds of swing dancers from all over the world descend on a small fishing town a couple of hours outside Stockholm, transforming it into what they call the home of the world's happiest feet. It's called the Harang Dance Camp. When it started in the early 1980s, it heralded the present-day resurgence of both the dancing and the 1920s and 1930s music associated with it. It just so happens that one of our contributors, Alexei Korolev, is also a swing dancer. In this July, he went by the camp for his fourth time in a row, and he sent us this report.
This seems surreal to me every time I come here, frankly. People from all corners of the globe, and there's a big map here to back me up, gathering in this dormant Swedish village with 4G internet access to dance to music from some entirely different age. Lennart Westerlund has been a key figure in the swing dance revival. He's also one of the founders of the Harang Dance Camp. It was nowhere near this big back in the day, he says.
First of all, it started back in 1982. 25 people came the first year, and when we decided to do it the second year, 1983, then some more people came, and then it was even some people from other cities in Sweden. So we understood that there was a little bit of an interest. So at that time, maybe 83, maybe 84, the decision was to make it as a yearly event. The camp expanded to 2 weeks in the later part of the 80s, but in 1989 there was a big change.
That year, Frankie Manning, the late pioneer of the Lindy Hop, the most popular of the swing dancers, first came to Harang to teach.
And Frankie was an enormous success. Frankie was the right person somehow to pass on the Lindy. He was a good teacher. He was full of inspiration, and people liked him. People really liked him. So at that time, the dance started to spread in Sweden on a social level among people in general. And then I think people liked Herräng. They liked the village itself. Go to the beach, you know, you could rest a little bit. You had your classes and so on. So that was the beginning years. And from that point, both 82 and 89, both key years, more and more people came. And in the early 90s, it was obvious that it was also for foreigners.
Hi, I'm Erica George. I'm from America, Washington, D.C. I'm a swing dancer. Herräng is sort of a magical wonderland located in the woods of somewhere Sweden. There's houses and dormitories sort of dotted around everywhere, and we've made sort of temporary tents for our dance classes. And we have sort of a stretch around the town where we have a local place where people dance and eat, and then another place that is more for the dances late at night and for keeping people quiet around the neighborhood.
Hi, my name is Minu Eriksson. I'm 25 years old and I'm from Sweden. First of all, I just love dancing. And this is the place to be when it comes to swing dancing. It's totally amazing. And the fact that it grows bigger every year, that's like, oh, I get chills thinking about it.
One of the people helping swing dancing to grow is Ramona Stafford. A one-time student of Frankie Manning's, she's now an instructor in her own right.
Herräng Dance Camp is, for me, the epitome of the modern Lindy Hop scene. It offers something for everybody, and it's a total immersion. So whether you like it or not, you are soaking up new experiences, talking to new people, dancing with people you haven't danced with before, and the food is wonderful, so there's something for all of the senses.
And this is your, which time in Herräng?
Oh gosh, my first year was 1998. I came a bit at 2001, too, and then I was studying modern dance, actually, in New York, and doing work dancing with a company and moving maybe in a different direction, and then I, of course, always came back to the Lindy Hop. Well, I teach by setting an example, so leading by being, just how I conduct myself and the thing that comes across without words, actually.
Let's meet a couple of other teachers.
My name is Peter Strom.
And I'm Naomi Uyama.
And as crazy it is, as it is taking over this fishing village, it's sort of its own little village unto itself. It exists for 5 weeks in the summer, and it's just part of our summer now. I mean, it's just what I do. I don't even plan anything else. July is, it belongs to Sweden and Herräng.
The Swedes really made a big effort to find some of the old-timers and bring them out, and that's certainly what established Herräng as one of the biggest dance camps, is that they brought old-timers that you could learn from for an extended period of time, and the feeling and generosity that some of those old-timers extended, such as Frankie Manning, really infused the camp with a certain vibe.
There's one big question, though. We've seen trends come and go, so is there a possibility that the swing craze may also go someday? Peter Strom is optimistic.
I think the craze is unlikely to stop soon. The current swing craze, if we can call it that, it's lasted longer than the original swing craze at this point. And also, it's got a global sense of connection. This has become something of a niche cultural thing. It's something that people have to come to a bit separately on their own. It's an interest that they take and something that sort of grows on them. And the experience of it is, it's not so readily available that you can throw it away so easily. And so I think the people who are doing it are pretty committed to doing it and will likely be around doing it for a while. I mean, I certainly will. And I think several of the people here at a camp like Herräng will too.
For Monocle and Herräng, I'm Alexi Korolev.
I'm flying high, but I've got a feeling I'm falling.
Thanks, Alexi. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. After the break, we'll meet a duo creating beautifully hand-stitched photography books. Stay tuned.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We meet now Jane Wilson and Jeremy Kunzer of independent publishing company Jane and Jeremy. A sideline project to their day jobs, Jane is an artist and photographer and Jeremy is a graphic designer. The couple set up Jane and Jeremy after meeting on a night out in Soho in 2006, so they don't all have to be destructive. Since then, they've gone on to produce numerous books of photographs which are sold all over the world. Working from their charming flat in South London, the duo pride themselves on the aesthetic and process of their books. Using top-quality uncoated paper, they're hand-bound and stitched with coloured open spines, showcasing exciting new photography whilst being beautiful art objects in their own right. Monocle's Harriet Baker met them to find out more.
I come from a photography background and fine art, so quite interested in limited editions and things like that, which I guess sort of relays into our books being small handmade editions and quite unique objects in themselves. My photography background comes from working at Claire de Rune Books and Zwemer when it was Zwemer, which obviously was a great insight into the world of publishing and photography books. And I kind of became a bit obsessed with photography books and buying them and spending my wages on photography books. But then Claire was really inspiring and sort of encouraged me and Jeremy to do our own thing after we made one little book, The Book of Kisses, which she sold in her shop, and it went down really, really well. The Book of Kisses was our first book, XXX, and that was made in 2004, and it was based on another project that I'd done, taking Polaroids of kisses off the TV screen, and Jeremy found the Polaroids and just thought it'd be nice as a book, and that's how it all sort of started. We did a book of death scenes from films, and then the rest just sort of rolled on from there.
I suppose with Jane and Jeremy, how we choose or select projects, it's slightly different, it varies. Sometimes photographers come to us, whereas sometimes we go to photographers who we really, really like and admire.
So yeah, this is Henry Rose.
That's his new book. We went to New York and did the New York Art Book Fair, and by chance Mark Borthwick was doing a signing there, and Jane really, really loved his work since Claire's shop days, and we had tea at his house and showed him our work, and yeah, and showed him our books basically to him, and he loved it and he wanted to do one. So that's kind of how we sort of started to get people who are actually well-established photographers involved.
And seems like the photographers we work with always understand our aesthetic as well, because they kind of like, oh, I've got a perfect project for your kind of, but there's always a project which is normally quite personal, close to their heart, or something that hasn't fitted into something else they've done. There's always like a project without a home, which our books kind of, they're projects that these photographers have done on a personal whim, and they quite suit our style, I think, because it's kind of quite intimate.
Very precious
handmade objects, yeah.
Yeah, I think all of our books are really well considered. We obviously sort of start out by looking at the set of photographs and either working with the photographer and looking at how the book flows, how the images flow, and then we'll come around to, you know, designing the covers, you know, what sort of process will we use, like letter pressing or foiling. Sometimes it's just printing on. And also like the stocks, paper stocks as well, is very important. Our books are, like Jane was saying, very precious and intimate, lightweight. And I think that gives a sense of, it's just being very, very nice to hold.
The books have been sewn at this stage, and it's just to reinforce the spine, I use a binding paste. So I have to clamp the books first of all. So I'm just gonna clamp these.
Just using bulldog clips.
It's 50% PVA glue, which is neutral and acid-free. so it won't discolour the book in time, just to reinforce the spines. And that will take about a couple of hours to dry, and then Jeremy will put the covers on.
So basically I just trim the edges off, so if you want it. There's that, so it's nice and neat. I mean, we also put like the end papers on as well. These are what the end papers look like. And basically we cut those out as well.
They're always a different stock to the image pages. And they're all
the same size.
They look like a collection in themselves, so I think that's quite important. They're all uniform. We keep the same dimensions. They're a different amount of pages and things like that, but the binding's always the same, and the colours of the cover and things like that. It's all quite thought out in terms of them being an overall thing as well as an individual thing.
That was Jane Wilson and Jeremy Kunzer of Jane and Jeremy Publishers speaking to Harriet Baker. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Next time, we'll venture into the world of British folk traditions and pagan weirdness. So attach some bells to your shoes and don your best bog snorkel for that. You've been tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher. Thank God she's come back from holiday tanned and spruce. And thanks to Paul Noble and Tom Hall for holding the fort while she swanned her way around North America. Time for one final song then from our favourite releases of the summer. This is a new band to end with. They're called Woman's Hour and hail from Kendal in the Lake District of England, but make their music in London. What music? That sort of voguish, synthy, spacey pop fronted by glacial yet sensual girl singer. But they do it very well. This is To The End from their record Conversations. Thanks for tuning in. And